Fisheries will come to order at 10:05 a.m. in room 120. Today is Thursday, March 17th. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everyone. Members present today are Representative Ortiz, Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Millett, and myself, Chair Stutes. Let the record reflect we do have a quorum to conduct business. We are also joined by Kelly Burnett from House Records, Cody Grussendorf from the LIO, and of course, my trusty Fisheries Committee aide, Reed Harris. Today we have two bills on the agenda, House Bill 241 and House Bill 366. It's my intent to hear the sponsors' presentations, take invited testimony, and then table the bills until a later date when we will hear public testimony on them. The first bill we will hear is House Bill 241, an act relating to the non-resident surcharge for commercial fishing permits. And presenting the bill is the sponsor, Representative Millett, and her staff, Grace Abbott.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Charisse Millett, representative for District 25. Thank you, Chairman Stutes, for hearing House Bill 241 this morning. House Bill 241 is an attempt to fall in line with the requirements for folks that buy resident commercial fishing licenses. And with your indulgence, Madam Chair, I'm just going to ad lib a little bit here. I think our fishing resource is an economy and a blessing and something that we are really lucky to have, and I think in that light that we should hold it to its highest level. In that spirit, 241 is to recognize that the residents here in Alaska do get an advantage when they buy their fishing licenses and permits, and that residents pay a lower fee than non-residents. However, we have seen through a little investigation that the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission has identified 2,289 individuals currently claiming to be residents for the purpose of permits that are ineligible for PFDs. With that thought, that my friend from Southeast and I had a nice conversation about what would it be and what would the increase to the fees collected if we captured those folks that were actually non-residents but claiming to be residents to get their commercial fishing permits. In the spirit of that, we thought it was unfair to those that who are actually residents. There was a feeling that if you are truly a resident, we should true up your residency through the ability to track you through your permanent fund, with obvious exemptions for those folks that don't, that are Alaska residents that don't qualify for the PFD. So, Madam Chair, this bill, in essence, does that. I spoke to Deputy Commissioner Brooks on the way in, and there is a residency requirement now that CFEC has, but this would true up our residency requirements, that those folks that truly are residents that apply for their PFD are really the residents that we would like to honor with the lower permits, and those that are non-residents should be, by law, paying the non-residents fee. I know that we have many different residency requirements throughout our statutes, and at some point in time, I think we all can agree that the permanent fund residency requirements work. They're enforceable. They're tried, true, and tested. And at some point in time, I hope that all of our residency requirements for not only commercial fishing permits, but sports fishing permits and other permits that are provided throughout the statute and benefits to residents of the state of Alaska could have one identifying residency requirement, which we can check through the permanent fund status. So with that, Madam Chair, that is the intent of the legislation, and I have Grace Abbott, who is now becoming a fisheries expert, which I'm so pleased to hear, to go through the sectional and any questions that she or I can answer, or we have Commissioner from CFEC here, Commissioner Brown. We also have Deputy Commissioner Kevin Brooks here, and I'm sure we have folks online, and Commissioner Cotton should be available for questions too. So thank you. With that,
Thank you, and I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome Representative Herron and welcome Grace. Nice to see you. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Grace Abbott, staff to Representative Millett. I'll quickly go through our sectional, and it's quick because it's just two sections. It touches both the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission and the Permanent Fund Corporation. Section 1 defines a non-resident as an individual who is not eligible to receive a permanent fund dividend, and that residency may be proved by showing eligibility for a permanent fund dividend. And then Section 2 amends the duties of the Department of Revenue to include confirming for the Alaska Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission that an individual is eligible to receive a permanent fund dividend. And you should see in your backup documents that we've provided information on what the Department of Fish and Game is currently deeming to be residency requirements, and then the eligibility criteria for the permanent fund dividend. The Dividend Corporation has made their eligibility criteria very user-friendly. There are lots of online resources, as well as paper resources for people to figure out whether or not they qualify, a lot of scenarios that they run through, and I can't commend them highly enough for being willing to walk through that process with anyone who calls or emails. So.
Thank you, and excuse me for just a moment while I welcome Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I have a question for you, and that would be, how are you addressing, or how does this address people that are residents but are not eligible for the PFD, such as maybe a felon or somebody that's having their PFD taken for child support or anything along those lines?
Absolutely. Madam Chair, once again, this is Grace Abbott for the record. At this point, the bill does not address felons. That was an issue that your office did bring to us and that we've considered as one of the opportunities to make this a better bill, to include a exception for felons or people who are not eligible to receive the economic benefit of the permanent fund, but are in fact residents. So that is definitely a policy call for the committee and something to take under consideration.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Herron.
Yes, thank you. Grace, following the same line of thought there, is there are people that choose not to apply and could be for a couple of number of reasons, they don't need the money. Another one that's is it's probably very uncommon, but people choose not to apply for a permanent fund because they don't want to serve on jury duty. So I guess that's sort of the oddball situation that we have is that. You don't get selected for jury duty if you don't apply for a permanent fund. And so this could be one of those exceptions we'll have to figure out. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Representative Miller.
Thank you. And Representative Herron, we did identify that there's probably a long exemption list that we need to include, and there's other ways to prove residency that I don't think would be cost prohibitive and that could be done, and we just need to write an amendment with all, including all those exemptions. And so we're perfectly happy to do that. And we knew that coming into it that we would have a conversation about who is a resident that doesn't get the dividend, and for various reasons. So we're very open to some friendly amendments that would help us define better who those folks are.
And
thank you.
Through the chair, if I may, once again, Grace Abbott for the record, through the chair, Representative Herron, whether or not a person actually receives the dividend doesn't affect their eligibility as well. So someone who is not interested, and this is something that I've went through conversations with the Department of Revenue as well, but someone who is not interested in receiving a dividend or perhaps not interested in serving jury duty or interested in spiting creditors was one of the examples I heard as well, their eligibility remains the same, and that could be determined without them necessarily having to receive the dividend.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Ms. Abbott? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And next up, we will have House Bill 366. An act relating to commercial fishery entry permits, establishing regional community permit banks and regions for certain commercial fishing permits, relating to commercial fishing entry permits and regions leased and controlled by a regional community permit bank, relating to the duties of Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission and the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and providing for an effective date. And presenting this bill is Representative Christ Tompkins and his staff, Reed Magdance.
Thank you.
Your name and begin. Thank you.
Madam Chair, for the record, Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins, representing rural Southeast Alaska. Important to note the last name of Reed Magdans, given the presence of another individual by the same wonderful name in this room. It's a real pleasure. It's been a sort of a long road to get to this point, to present House Bill 366. And this is a bill that was motivated, when I was in college, learning more about Alaska fisheries and the history of Alaska fisheries and the huge economic role they play in coastal communities, and how they sustain coastal communities and those economies, and how we as a state can get the maximum economic value and benefit for our coastal economies and coastal communities. And in recent years, it became a little bit more relevant, given that we as a state are pretty broke right now, and we're in a position where we need to try to find a way to create as much possible value out of the assets that we already have, basically. And our fisheries resource is an amazing asset, and it renews every year to the tune of billions of dollars. And so this bill is motivated to try to create more sort of economic value out of this tremendous and renewable resource that we as Alaska have. But it's also motivated by a sort of principle of empowerment. We have a lot of rural communities that are to varying degrees struggling economically and socially, and I think it's really important to give them tools to be able to empower themselves and become self-sufficient, so that they don't, to the greatest extent possible, need to rely on outside entities or institutions. And historically, these have been proud fishing communities. Some of them still are, some of them less so in recent time. And I think the more that we can help them become economically empowered, the more vital those communities become in every regard. So, maybe a quick overview of how we're going to try to break this down. We've got a number of testifiers lined up, all of whom from different perspectives, different backgrounds. Commissioner Cotton will be testifying by phone, and he's been a big part of this conversation for most of the last year. Paula Kohlenberg, the director of UAC Grant, is going to testify. She's really familiar with the data and sort of the academic background of what's happening in terms of fishing permits leaving coastal Alaska and leaving the state of Alaska. Linda Bankin, executive director of Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association, a fishing group. Jim Brennan, an attorney who can speak to some of the legal and constitutional considerations involved. A young fisherman, Tyler Emerson. John Sturgeon, who has recently accrued some notability with his Supreme Court case that was the last case heard by Justice Scalia, but has also been involved in these rural economic development issues, and all different perspectives, and we're excited to hear their sort of very sort of short views on the importance of trying to solve this problem. But quickly, when I was in college, I became more familiar reading about the history of Alaska commercial fishing, and you know, a lot of the native villages in Alaska were the original commercial fishing communities, and Alaska natives in many ways pioneered, well, I mean, in a literal sense, all of Alaska's fisheries, but also a lot of Alaska's commercial fisheries in the early 20th century, and that proud tradition continued, but in many communities since limited entry, there's been a loss of permits from these communities, and it has led to economic struggle, and there's also, you know, some I guess maybe alienation from commercial fishing because people don't have access to this tremendously valuable resource. So in November 2014, we with many, many others, then Commissioner Campbell, people in the fishing industry started working on this idea, basically a tool that would allow new and young fishermen to enter commercial fishing and try to reverse some of the trend lines that we have with permits leaving Alaska communities and leaving the state of Alaska. And we've just put our heads down. We've tried to do the best possible work. We think we've got a half-decent idea. It's got, you know, a ways to go, and that's what the legislative process is for. We don't expect this to pass this year, but just sort of want to share some of the work we've done to date. We got this particular draft, which is the ninth draft of this bill over the previous 17 months, at 350 on the filing deadline. We ran it down to the chief clerk at 3, we got it at 3 o'clock, we ran it down at 350, the filing deadline was 4 p.m., so there's maybe a few incongruencies in the draft from what we were intended, but it, you know, at least gets to the general idea. So, and the idea, I wanted to touch on that briefly before allowing a few of the testifiers to share their perspective. And basically, if you know, I'm a young person, I get out of college or I come back home, and if I'm looking for a place to live, maybe before I go out and buy a house and mortgage the next 20 years of my life, I'm probably going to rent. And in fact, that's what I do. And the idea is you've got these really expensive fisheries to break into, and trying to create a tool that's sort of an intermediate step for new fishermen, young fishermen, to enter commercial fishing before they outright buy, and sort of a stepping stone, if you will. And that's sort of the idea behind this permit bank model, is that new and young fishermen can access a permit bank permit for a few years, learn the ropes, make some mistakes, save some money, and then hopefully have the wherewithal and feel more confident and willing to take on a huge amount of debt and take on a huge amount of risk to go out and buy a permit and become an independent fisherman and a small business person. And right now, with the absence of that stepping stone, it's pretty formidable for people to take that step. And the cost of entry into these fisheries has gone well in excess of inflation over the previous decade. So it gets harder and harder as time progresses, and really only those with access to capital are able to take that step. And so this is sort of an idea motivated to create that stepping stone, to create another tool for new fishermen, just as the Division of Investments has been so tremendously helpful to commercial fishing in Alaska over the previous 20 or 30 years. It would create regional structures, CFEC administrative areas, using those that are already set out, which roughly mirror ANCSA regional corporation boundaries, very roughly. It would create sort of a community governance structure similar to some CDQ groups that exist. And these permit banks, regional permit banks that would be community governed, would acquire permits on the open market, a very small number. There's a very conservative, what we call consolidation cap, and then make those permits available to new and young fishermen who are trying to get into fishing. Again, as that stepping stone that they can use for a few years, make the mistakes, save some money, and then take that final step. So that's the idea in a nutshell. You know, if and when this were to pass into law, my guess is that, you know, there would just be a few regions that would actually form permit banks, and they would just sort of dip their toe into the water. This bill provides them no money. They have to go find their own money. It just creates the vessel and the mechanism and provides the tool. So the regions really have to bootstrap themselves. It's up to them. Some regions might. Some regions probably won't. It really just leaves each region to their own destiny. So that's the idea in a nutshell. And I'd be happy to take any quick clarifying questions, but also just want to sort of defer to the testifiers as well.
Representative Heron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was a big nutshell.
So, a walnut.
I must agree with you, is compared to the colleagues that are in this room, yes, you are young, and only others can give out designations of being an elder, but in a lot of ways you are a little elder already. But I guess the thing I did really appreciate is in your very opening statement, is it does take a community or a village to raise a fisherman. I mean, it really does. And so I like the concept, and And I'm sure that we'll all of us will work together to see if we can realize this. But I guess the final comment or question is, so I'm sure you've, or I think you've probably heard some opposition to this, and did that motivate you to keep moving because of an ignorant opponent?
I would say, you know, well-intended questions and concerns. I think everyone, and I've really yet to meet anyone that, well, anyone that lives in Alaska, I should say, that doesn't agree that this is a problem, you know, worth solving. I mean, it's only a positive. There's only an upside. You know, the question is the best mechanism and means. And over the 17 months, I've traveled to Kodiak and to Homer and to Dillingham because, you know, growing up in Southeast, I'm just happen to be familiar with the fisheries of Southeast and want to try to have a, you know, think through this model in every setting and every fishery in every region, and get as much ideally constructive and critical feedback as possible. And that's mostly what the last 17 months have been, and you know what the next 7 or 8 months will be. So there have been some really good suggestions, all of which have been incorporated in this bill. I mean, again, we're in 9 drafts, and there are sure to be more. I think there's one concern, which is, you know, we've got the status quo. It's working pretty well for some, and that's true. But I think these trend lines are really negative and really concerning and merit action. Maybe not everyone sort of weights that perspective quite as much. But I think in terms of economic development in rural Alaska, it's an important issue, and I'd rather not wait if we can help it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Millett.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Chris Tompkins. I think this is a really fabulous idea. The barrier to entry for a young person getting into the fisheries is substantial. Unless you are lucky enough to have a parent who has a permit that got from their parent that will pass it down to you as a child, you see that a lot as a way that permits are perpetuated through the family. But if you're not so lucky and you don't have a family that has a permit, it is excruciatingly difficult to get financing, to get the money, to put the permit, the down payment on the permit, and then you're beholden to the price of fish every year. It's really a difficult business to make money at when you're 18, 19, 20. I currently have a son who's 22 working to get a permit in Bristol Bay, and every year he goes out, and it is a difficult process. So I really commend you on this idea. I think keeping our permits in our communities is one way to have a regional balance for economic development, and I think it's incredibly important to pass those on. It is the culture and the fabric that has been Alaska since time immemorial, fishing and subsistence, and it takes it to another level. So I appreciate that. Who, if any, is opposed to this type of permit banking? And we're talking about a small amount of permits and communities. I know fishing is competitive, but what has been the pushback from you going to your communities and talking to folks?
Yeah, I would say there's sort of two classes of questions that come up when we talk about this idea. One is legal and constitutional, and it's completely legitimate, and we've spent an immense amount of time. I mean, we've spent as much time talking with attorneys over the last half year as we have with fish people. There's the question, you know, you might have a great idea, but is it constitutional? And we've worked with the Department of Law, senior attorney at the Department of Law. We've worked with Ledge Legal, and we've worked with a private fisheries attorney in Anchorage who's worked pro bono on this. And there are several constitutional needles you kind of have to thread. And part of the reason we've gone through so many drafts is I think we've threaded those fairly well. Not to say there's not room for improvement, but there's been an immense amount of analysis, and this is a fairly constitutionally fortified product, incorporating the counsel and guidance of a lot of these attorneys. So that's one, I mean, which is really independent of whether the idea is good or otherwise. The second sort of class of concern is, this is something new. It basically works around the existing system. It allows people to access permits for a limited period of time via lease. Technically, that already happens with emergency medical transfer. And there is a market. You can go online to a broker and look at permits for lease via emergency medical transfer. But, that this is sort of a second instance of that. And some people have caution, and I appreciate that. I guess ultimately I feel the benefit outweighs the cost. Another sort of point of concern is this allows, in addition to CFAB and the Division of Investments, sort of another entity that can sort of be involved with permits. Technically, all these permits would be held by the Division of Investment, so it wouldn't create a new precedent, but nonetheless, you're sort of still working in that system, and that makes some people uncomfortable. Frankly, maybe the biggest concern is this institution. it's a fishing bill. Fishing bills can go crazy in this building. I think we've tried to work closely with the administration just because, that sort of offers a final safeguard potentially if it gets to the third floor and turns into Frankenstein. Maybe another point of concern is, it can start out as a great idea and it can turn, just as with any bill, can turn into something very different. Maybe that's a brief summary. But it's definitely, it's a new thing. It's a new idea. And, there's a learning curve to climb. I want to make really clear, we have looking forward to the interim to talk with a lot more people, talk with UFA, talk with a lot of these member groups. We've done it a lot, but we have a ways to go. And just that sort of point of humility, I think, is important to put on the record.
So I imagine that it's generated great interest in communities that are looking to have more economic development for, kids getting of age where they can own a permit and manage it. Have you seen any pushback from any communities, or has it been pretty well received within the communities you visited?
Yeah, very, very well received. In particular, Bristol Bay, Kodiak, and Southeast Alaska are the three that sort of come to mind most, partly because I think those are the regions you've seen the biggest outflow of permits and, struggle to create economic development. So those three areas, if this were the law, I would expect those three regions to sort of bootstrap pretty quickly.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm pretty confident that would happen. Other regions of the state, maybe a little less so. In the Cook Inlet, there's been very little permit loss, so this is, to a certain degree, a non-issue. It's a pretty resident fleet, out of Homer, for instance. So a lot of regional variation. Communities have been really supportive. And there's a lot of partner groups also, and the bill's crafted to try to, instead of, build a new sort of system to tie into existing functional institutions, native corporations, aquaculture associations, ARTRs, like Southwest Conference or Southeast Conference. So a lot of those sort of partner entities have been really interested in an active part of crafting this, CDQ groups out west also.
And one final follow-up.
Thank Representative.
You. No. And then Representative Chris Tompkins, do you have for us in the specific fisheries just a chart that shows us how many permits are out of state and are community held, are Alaska residents, and then the three different categories, so local, statewide, and then outside Alaska, that you could get us for each of the fisheries? Because I think once folks take a look at that, especially in Bristol Bay and some of the other fishing fleets in Southeast, it's astonishing how many of our permits have migrated out of the state.
Yeah, we can absolutely provide that. And some of the numbers, but and especially the trend lines are negative.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. If you'd supply that to the chair, we will make sure all the committee members have a copy of it. Are there any other questions for Representative Christ Tompkins? Then let's move forward to our testimony, and we will start with Commissioner Cotton. Commissioner Cotton, are you online?
Yes, Madam Chairman. Can you hear me?
We certainly can. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Sam Cotton. I'm the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Shall I go ahead?
Please do.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Here to offer support for House Bill 366. The Walker Mallott Fisheries Committee, which was part of the transition team, and by the way, the Fisheries Committee was made up of quite a broad spectrum of participants from a lot of different political persuasions, as well as user groups that were interested in fisheries in general. And they identified five priority issues and had recommendations for addressing those priorities. Immediately after the Fish First policy, the committee identified a priority of improving fisheries access for Alaskans and returning fisheries access opportunities to residents of Alaska's fishing communities. They specifically had goals of increasing Alaska ownership of licenses, permits, and quotas, as well as increasing participation by coastal residents, and supported a policy that ties rights, fishing rights, to communities. They specifically recommended legislation that would establish entities, recognize community entities, to retain or recapture commercial fishing licenses and permits for the use and benefit of community residents. And also very specifically supported establishing fisheries trusts or permit banks that allow investment in recapturing, retaining commercial quotas and licenses for the use of and benefit of coastal Alaskans. So the committee also identified some potential barriers and included, including as the representative, the sponsor, pointed out some constitutional and some legal issues. And I want to just add that we're also dealing with some of these, some similar issues on the federal level at the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, dealing with community entities been given the ownership opportunity for fishing rights. And it's becoming even more important as other management plans that are being proposed would have an impact on state waters. So it's the state's paying attention to this on a federal level as well. I think that you've got from the sponsor statement and other materials you have there that outlines the statistics and data that clearly show that there has been out-migration, especially of salmon permits and other CFEC permits and especially rural areas of Alaska. And as I look through the packet of materials here, I read many of the letters that are supportive of this, and I also read a couple letters that opposed the legislation. And I think some of the issues raised there were constitutional issues, as well as some other concerns about effects on permit values, and one of them even discussed the potential for the processors to gain an advantage as a result of a structure that's being proposed here. And again, I'm sure you're all well aware that that's part of what the process has involved now for you to examine those questions and ensure that that these proposals can meet the requirements of Alaska's Constitution, especially Article 8, Section 15, and the equal rights protections under Article 1. But we do not support, by the way, giving individuals the ability to lease or otherwise enjoy benefits of a permit without participation. I think that's a very dangerous path to take, but having a community permit bank would be quite different and perhaps not solve all the economic woes of some of these small communities, but we feel there's a real strong potential for positive impacts, and as a result, we encourage the committee to advance this hopefully beyond the conceptual stage, and again, we think it's going to be it's got great potential for positive impacts for Alaska residents and their ability to take advantage of fishing opportunities where there's little other economic opportunities. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner. Are there questions from this committee for Commissioner Cotton? Seeing none, Commissioner, we thank you for your testimony. Next, we will have Paula Cullenberg. Paula?
Thank you, Chairman Stutz. Can you hear me?
We certainly can. Please identify yourself and your affiliation and begin your testimony.
Okay, well, thank you. Good morning. My name is Paula Cullenberg. I'm the director of the Alaska Sea Grant Program. Alaska Sea Grant's a university UAF-based program, and we have worked on issues related to supporting strong communities and economies and healthy marine resources in our state for about 46 years. We do that through research, education, and through our Marine Advisory Program extension agents. And the issue of the graying of the fleet and the loss of permits and catch quota from Alaska communities has been a concern of our program for a number of years, and actually I believe that the graying of the fleet, the coining of the graying of the fleet or the increased age of permit holders in our state was coined about 15 years ago in Petersburg. You know, Alaska's fisheries are, as you know, critical, sustainable source of employment, income, cultural identity, state and local tax revenue for the state of Alaska and its residents, and in many fishery-dependent communities, there really is a lack of any other alternative economic opportunities for private income. So permits and quotas are leaving communities, and local residents are not able to afford to retain access or to enter fisheries. And ownership of Alaska fishery access by non-Alaskans has also grown. So loss of that access leads to loss of economic opportunities in fishery-dependent communities, and also an inability to keep the value of Alaska's fish resources within the communities and the individuals of Alaska. So it hinders the ability for a community, for example, to know whether to invest in infrastructure, whether to put together ice machines or harbor improvements to be able to plan long-term, not knowing what kind of access there will be in a community. And so this is really bad for our state as a whole, and especially at a time when we're really trying to reinvent a diverse and a sustainable economy. And in fact, this House Fisheries Committee in 2012 passed a resolution encouraging the state to look at the graying of the fleet and try and address that in our state. So Sea Grant certainly has contributed in a number of ways. You know, we've done the Young Fishermen Summit, and I'm sure you remember hearing from them in January six times to try and help new fishermen understand the complexities of the fishing industry. And we are co-sponsoring with the North Pacific Research Board the Graying of the Fleet Research Project that's looking at youth perceptions of their future in the commercial fishing industry in the communities of the Kodiak Archipelago and in Bristol Bay. And then in January, we hosted a two-day workshop with a steering committee of other Alaskans titled Fisheries Access for Alaska, Charting the Future. And I know that a number of you participated in that workshop. I was really surprised by how many Alaskans came from across the state to talk about this issue. We had over 100 Alaskans attending from Southeast, from the Alaska Peninsula, from Kodiak, from Bristol Bay. So one of my takeaways from that workshop was that this is definitely a state issue. This is not a regional specific issue. This is something that people across the state are concerned about. And the other main takeaway for me was that our current market-based access system has just not been able to prevent limited entry permits or catch quota from leaving our rural communities and from Alaska as a whole. And so at the workshop, we considered a range of recommended solutions, both for individuals and for communities. And, you know, this is not it's not an easy issue. It's a complex issue. It will probably take a number of different approaches to really see the tide turned in the downward trends that Representative Christ-Tompkins mentions. And when you look at the numbers, I think you'll be impressed by how consistent that downward trend is around the state. Some of the solutions that we came up with, I think, should be sort of looked at in a few main methods. One is, does a solution create an intergenerational path? So do we have a good way for young people to get into fishing? Do we also have a good way for older people who are ready to get out of the business exit with neither of them taking on this huge risk so that can happen pretty seamlessly? And then is it linked to communities and regions so that we can potentially as the communities can continue to support the fishery? And then is there some kind of mentorship and ability to help young people as they come in? And I think that HB 366 is one of those tools. It does make that regional community link that's so important to have some security. And I, you know, the end of the workshop, folks were, consensus was that they would like to see coastal Alaska have a thriving, stable, intergenerational participation in local fisheries so that communities can support fishing businesses with infrastructure and amenities that make people want to stay, and that basic income from local fisheries is part of a diverse local economy. So I'm happy to provide more details on any of that information, but I do think that this is a valuable tool that will help us move forward in decreasing that downward trend. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions from this committee for Ms. Kullenberg? Thank you, Paula. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Next we have Linda Benkin from SIDCA. Are you there, Linda?
I am here. Thank you. Good
Great.
Morning.
Please state your name, your affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Linda Benkin. I am the Executive Director of Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association. We are based here in SIDCA. We have members primarily in Southeast Alaska, but also some from other parts of the state, as well as a few from outside the state. I've been executive director since the 90s. I've also been a commercial fisherman out of Sitka for over 30 years and have fished from Sitka out to the Bering Sea and back, so have had a fair bit of exposure and opportunity to visit all the communities along Alaska's coast. I've also served on the North Pacific Council for 9 years and been very involved in this issue of losing access and what that does to the communities of Alaska, particularly the rural and remote communities in Alaska. Our group does support this bill. As I said, we've, as an organization, had a really long-standing concern about losing access, and since 2009, have been actively involved in trying to reverse the trend of losing access from Alaska's communities. It took us a bit of time. It took me a bit of time to warm up to the idea of this bill. We were initially very concerned about opening up, making these kind of changes to allow communities to own permits. Anybody who knows me and knows our group knows that we are fierce champions for independent fishermen. We're very committed to the owner-operated nature of Alaska's fisheries. We've always opposed leasing and looked for ways to retain that owner-operated nature to keep small boats, small community boats, viable in these fisheries and successful. But as we worked with Jonathan on this bill, it became clear to us that permit banks are a really important step to retaining, supporting, and building the opportunities for independent fishermen to help overcome the risks that fishermen in our communities are facing right now in gaining access, both the cost of access and the risks fishermen face in those early years of changes in fish prices, of abundance of the fish, of how to run a business, how to run a boat when you're first getting started. And that permit banks could be a really important part of the solution to help people go make it through those early years, to mentor them in those important skills so that they are eventually successful in the long term. I have heard the same concerns about whether this would open up Alaska's fisheries to corporate ownership, to leasing, to the changes to our fisheries that I know our group really opposes. And I would point out that, as the sponsor did, that currently the programs that are in place to help new entrants, the CFAB program, the State Revolving Loan Fund, allow those groups in very limited and controlled situations to be in a first position on a loan, to actually own a limited entry permit, hold a limited entry permit if someone defaults on a loan. So in a sense, this is a program that provides access that mirrors those other programs. It has to be done carefully. That's really important to us. But if it's done carefully, it doesn't open in our mind any kind of negative consequences as far as corporate ownership. In fact, it does the opposite. It supports independent fishermen in those early years in gaining access to these fisheries. And as I think has been mentioned by others, these are incredibly valuable fisheries. They are the economic cornerstone of our communities. Losing access really means losing communities. And if we don't do something to change this trend, the economic loss, the social loss, the cultural loss, it is significant up and down our coasts. So we thank the sponsor for all his really exhaustive and inclusive work over the last 17 months to explain this bill, to build the idea, to incorporate the concerns that we and others have expressed, and urge you to move ahead with it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Are there any questions from this committee? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. We have Jim Brennan.
Hi, this is Jim Brennan. Can you hear me?
We certainly can.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm an Anchorage attorney in private practice with the law firm of Brennan and Heidemann here, and I've been in continuous private practice in Alaska since 1976. I grew up in Petersburg. I commercially fished out of there as a crewman for many years. I've had a varied practice, which includes representation of burrows, including formation of several burrows. And I've done extensive work in appeals to the Alaska Supreme Court and Ninth Circuit. Much of these have involved constitutional issues. So I was asked by Representative Christ Tompkins to evaluate the constitutionality of the concept he was developing under both state and federal constitutions. The concept he was developing is, of course, what's now in the bill. It's an attempt to address the ongoing exodus of limited entry permits from many of our coastal communities. I've spent a lot of time on this on a pro bono basis, and have worked. I had extensive communications with Representative Christ Tompkins and his staff on this. I've looked at all the potential constitutional challenges under both constitutions, but this has ended up focusing on several primary constitutional issues. One is the general issue of discrimination against non-residents, residents of other states. This comes under the Federal Privileges and Immunities Clause. Another is concerns about unconstitutional discrimination generally under the Equal Protection Clauses of both the Alaska and Federal Constitution. And finally, concerns about creation of an exclusive right or special privilege of fishery as is prohibited by Article 8, Section 15 of the Alaska Constitution. While all of these raise legitimate concerns, I believe the constitutionality of the community permit bank system as embodied in the bill would be upheld if the statute is accompanied by carefully worded legislative findings and purposes, which the current draft does. I don't have enough time here, I don't think, to even outline my analysis of all of these issues, particularly the federal ones, but I'd like to address just briefly one particular issue, which is this concern about no exclusive right or special privilege of fishery under the Alaska Constitution. It's very important here that to note that the Alaska Constitution contains a specific clause that addresses the very subject matter of HB 366, which is a limited entry system. There was an amendment to Article 8, Section 15, that was done in 1972 and was adopted by the voters. I think it's best that I first read what the statute, what the constitutional clause did say. It initially said there be no exclusive right of special privilege of fisheries shall be created or authorized in the natural waters of the state. the amendment, which was adopted in 1972, went on to say, this section does not restrict the power of the state to limit entry into any fishery for purposes of resource conservation and to prevent economic distress among fishermen and those dependent upon them for a livelihood. That's a very specific constitutional clause, and one rarely finds something that specific in a constitution. And this particular clause has been interpreted by the Alaska Supreme Court to authorize limited entry statutes despite the fact, despite the no exclusive right or no special privilege of fishery clause, and also despite other constitutional clauses such as the equal protection, you know, non-discrimination clauses. So the important thing here is that a limited entry statute such as this one that's being contemplated by you, that as long as it is acting to, in the language of the Constitution, to prevent economic distress among fishermen and those dependent upon them for a livelihood, there's a very good chance that it will be upheld against constitutional challenge. In the business of defending statutes, as you folks well know, there are no lead pipe cinches. Nothing's guaranteed. But here you have a specific constitutional clause that is going to go a long ways towards helping defend this against any challenge. I would note in passing that a recent letter to the committee from AIFMA, I'm not really familiar with that group, but I think you've seen the letter. It cites to Article 8, Section 15's language about no exclusive right or special privilege of fishery, but it does not address the amendment language that says this section does not restrict the power of the state to authorize limited entry statutes. Also, that letter that you received cites to a number of Alaska Supreme Court cases. It's very important to note that none of those cases involve limited entry statutes. So they did not qualify for the benefits of the amendment language that was adopted by the voters in 1972. During the past year and a half, I've worked extensively with Representative Grice Tompkins and his staff to help shape and craft the bill so as to minimize the constitutional risks while retaining the purposes of the bill. I think what the bill is currently crafted is well designed to prevail against any such of a challenge. And in closing, I'd just like to say I've observed firsthand the loss of fishing permits, particularly in some of our smaller coastal communities, and I believe that this bill is a sound and constitutional approach to resolving that problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions for Mr. Brennan? Thank you, Mr. Brennan, for your testimony. We have Tyler Emerson, who happens to be here, a young fisherman. Welcome, Mr. Emerson.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Madam Chair, Committee, I represent myself, Tyler Emerson, as a salmon troller. As a young fisherman, I really think the proposal, House Bill 366, has a strong potential of expanding access to fisheries to people like myself, and growing economic opportunity for coastal communities. Myself, I'm a third-generation troller. I grew up here in Southeast and probably spent 15 of 24 summers that I've been alive out fishing on the boat with my dad. And fishing, you know, it provided a livelihood as well as a lifestyle for me that I really enjoyed. And in 2014, I kind of decided I wanted to purchase an operation of my own and began the search of trying to find a vessel and a permit. And it quickly became clear to me that one of the issues I would face was that I would need to find a vessel and a permit at the same time through the Division of Investments, which I ultimately was able to secure financing. They won't, wisely enough, I might add, but they're not going to secure, they're not going to give you a loan on a boat if you don't have access to the fishery, and they're not going to give you access to the fishery if you don't have a boat to go and harvest the resource. So you're kind of stuck in this catch-22 situation where you need to purchase both business assets, either of which at any time would be a large, you know, capital outlay. But you kind of have to do it both, you know, put both feet in at one time, and it's really a stretch. You know, the only way I was able to do it was, you know, through the assistance of the Division of Investments, as well as support from my family in the form of additional collateral that my dad had that he could secure against the loan. But I really think a permanent bank could help in this respect. You know, you could buy a vessel and not so much worry about buying the permit at the same time. You know, there would be a secondary source if you could have to go secure that asset and get access to the fishery. I think it would be make it a lot easier for fishermen to get involved in that way. And also to test out and transition into new fisheries. If I have a vessel that might be compatible with other fisheries, it might make it a lot easier for me to go do something else and kind of leverage that existing asset I have. Excuse me. So in that way, I think it lends itself to a more efficient, you know, allocation of capital, just getting more boats involved in more fisheries and just utilizing the same asset and different resource harvesting operations. I had the chance of attending the Young Fishermen's Summit in January. We testified in front of you, I believe, and you might have seen a letter that came across your desk that kind of shared a lot of the same views. Many participants were concerned about access, and especially, I mean, to more effect, with newer participants that don't have family connections. You know, I was always aware of the insular nature of the industry, you know, being in a fishing family, but I think at one point in the conference, you know, that it was asked, you know, how many people here are involved because of their family, and I would say it's at least 90% of the hands rose. I know, I think that kind of strikes to the difficulty of someone who doesn't have the connections or the resources to enter into the fishery, and I really don't think, I mean, it's great for me, right, as a family fisherman, but I think the resource needs to be allocated more equitably, you know, and not as a birthright, per se. I guess in closing, I'd really like you to consider this proposal. I really think it's going to do a lot to improve access for younger fishermen like myself, and also improve upon the effectiveness of existing state programs. You know, the Division of Investments is great. You know, it allowed me to get my foot in the door, but there still is a barrier. It's really hard to come up with your down payment working as a crew member, and if a lease option is there, I think it would make it a lot easier for someone to get into a vessel, get into a permit, and find the fishery that's right for them. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Emerson. Any questions from this committee? Thank you. We appreciate that. We have John Sturgeon from the Yuzinki Native Corporation.
Good morning, Madam Chair. You hear me?
We certainly can. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Again, my name is John Sturgeon, and today I'm representing Yuzinki Native Corporation. We support House Bill 366. We think it's a very good bill. What I'd like to do today is kind of give you a personal kind of history of how this would affect the village of Yuzinki. For those of you who aren't familiar with Yuzinki, it's a small village of 200 people, just a little bit northeast of Kodiak, Alaska. When limited entry was passed, the village of Yuzinki had 30-plus fishing boats. It was the core of the economy of Yuzinki. It was what basically everybody did. The fishing industry was moved on from family to family, a larger family to smaller family members, and it was a tradition in Yuzinki. Today, that the village of Yuzinki has two fishing boats, soon to be one. So the economic impact of the limited entry permit has been very devastating on the village of Yuzinki, and I think that if you look at the other villages in the Kodiak area, like Old Harbor, in Akiak, you'll find pretty much the same thing, that the fishing was the core of these villages' economy, and that is gone. These permits have filtered their way out of these small villages, and today many of them are left without much of an economy. One of the things that the Yuzinkin Native Corporation has been trying to do over the years is try to develop an economy in the village of Yuzinki. There's a small sawmill there, there's a few other small businesses, but nothing can replace the fishing industry. And this bill, we think, will help get back some of those fishing jobs. It's not going to be solve all the problems, but it'll help considerably. Yuzinki is a very proud village. It wants to have a stable economy, and fishing is one of the things that we think we know will allow us to have that. They do not want to be dependent upon government programs. They also want to make sure that their children can stay in Yuzinki and have jobs. Now most of the children, they graduate from high school, and they have to move on to the big city, Anchorage, or some other place to find employment because the fishing jobs just aren't there anymore. Not only has been an economic impact on Yuzinki over the years, but there's been a cultural impact, that fishing was the core of the culture of Yuzinki, that is being severely harmed. So I think Yuzinki is a real live example of what has happened with these limited entry permits drifting outside these villages and leaving a village like Yuzinki, which was a fishing village, left with one or two boats where before they had 30-plus boats. And I think this bill will go a long ways to help maybe resolve the problem, get some of those jobs back in the village of Yuzinki. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify. And again, we support House Bill 366 wholeheartedly. And thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Mr. Sturgeon? Seeing none, thank you. We appreciate your testimony. We have Nicole Borromeo. Am I right?
Close enough. Borromeo.
Oh, great. Thank you. If you'd state your name and identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Sure. My name is Nicole Borromeo, and I am with the Alaska Federation of Natives. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm not going to take a lot of time because I understand I am batting cleanup here, and a lot of what we were going to say has already been said. But just want to echo the sentiments of the bill sponsor and others that have previously testified. AFN, as the largest Alaska Native organization, having members from the corporate section, tribes, Native nonprofits, recognizes the problem here with the permits leaving rural Alaska. We've been working very closely with the bill sponsor as he has developed, I think he said this is the ninth draft. The bill has a real potential to make a difference in rural Alaska access, economic development, but we realize at the same time that interest and support varies among the different regions within the Native community. So we like the idea and concept. We're interested in moving it forward and look very much forward to working with the bill sponsor and the committee in, I guess, probably the next legislature.
Wonderful. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, and thank you for your testimony.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I do have a question, and I'm thinking maybe Commissioner Brown might be able to help me with this if he could come forward, please.
Absolutely, Madam Chairman. Benjamin Brown from the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission for the record.
Great, thank you. I'm curious if there would be any problems that you could foresee in light of the fact that the Commercial Fisheries Act says you must own the permit.
Madam Chairman, it's a pleasure to be before the House Special Committee on Fisheries. It's the first time I've been here this year, and it's also the first time I've been here since Max Gruenberg passed away. So I think his spirit is with us when we undertake debates about things of this magnitude, because there's always the potential for something to go wrong. And I think Mr. Brennan was very eloquent speaking to the upside I should first say, Commissioner Twomley and I wholeheartedly agree that Representative Christ Hopkins is pursuing the most laudable goal here, which is to really help Alaskans participate in fisheries. We could not be in any stronger agreement with him on his desired outcome. But I think it's always necessary to have a devil's advocate perspective when you undertake legislation of this magnitude, because if things go wrong, they could go really, really very wrong. I think Section 24 of this version of the bill is probably what caused me the most concern when I first read this version of it, because it takes away the proscription of who can't own a permit and who is not a person for the purposes of ownership of a permit. And I would respectfully suggest that might be one of the first things that you look at kind of trying to tighten up, because it takes away the prescription that a person does not include a corporation, company, partnership, firm, association, organization, joint venture, trust, society, or other legal entity other than a natural person. And I don't know that even if this bill were to move forward and you wanted to add a regional community permit bank as a second kind of person, you would want to take away all those other things that a person still is not. Because we talk about slippery slopes, and I think that would put you at the top of a really long luge of a slippery slope that could really end badly when you got to the bottom of it. So I think there might be a way to craft that so that you didn't take away all the things that a person still is not. And then the leasing, and this has already been mentioned, you know, Mr. Brennan spoke to this as well. Once you start saying, well, some people can lease permits, I guess the situation that might arise is a regular person like you or me who holds a permit might say, why can a community permit bank lease their permit and I can't? Why is that fair? Why is that reasonable? Why do I have to have a verifiable medical or other extraordinary emergency circumstance to justify the temporary alienation of my permit to someone else? So those, I think, are the two big 800-pound halibuts in the room that we would want to make sure we were really, really careful about getting the best possible answers to. Because I think Mr. Brennan's analysis from the optimistic, let's support this side, is really great, but I think you have to look at the counter-analysis, which is what if this didn't go well and what would the effect be?
Thank you. Representative Christ Tompkins.
Yeah, just a quick thought. In Section 24, I couldn't agree more, and this is a consequence of us getting the bill at 3 o'clock and having a 4 o'clock filing deadline. And when I first saw Section 24, there was a word that may have been uttered in our office that I shouldn't put on the record. So I couldn't agree more. It's definitely not the intent, and that's a language that I think would be the first to go.
Great. Thank you.
I'm happy to answer any other questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. We appreciate that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
And I'm gonna be bringing up something that's probably a little salt in the wounds, but didn't we have a scallop fisheries that you didn't have to be on board to fish, and that's almost a de facto lease of your quota? And did we do away with that, or did we just eliminate that particular use of the quote-unquote lease when we got the hairy crab Arter's bill back in, God, how long ago has that been? So I'm wondering, does that fit in? Because we were doing that at one point.
Madam Chairman, to respond to Representative Johnson's question, there were two fisheries that allowed for vessel-based permits, and the vessels could be owned by corporations and not by real persons. And critics of that program voiced the same concern that I just voiced about taking away the prescriptions and what a person is not, that it is a slippery slope, that it was going to lead to corporate ownership of other forms of permits. The wisdom of hindsight is there was a very heated battle in this building of several years ago about the wisdom of taking the sunset date out of the statute and letting that program continue in perpetuity. And the sunset date came and passed, and the fishery reverted to open access. The sky has not fallen. I think because most of those scallops are harvested in federal waters, and so the participants in the state waters fishery went out and got interim use permits in an open access fishery and have continued to behave like they behaved before. So that is a case where the slippery slope didn't materialize and bad things did not come to pass. There is still on the books Bering Sea hair crab fishery that allows for vessel-based limitation. It's a theoretical fishery because it's never been opened, because the managers or friends at Fish and Game have never decided that there was sufficient resource to be harvested there. So I don't know that the example of the vessel-based limitation system that went away when the sunset came and passed provides a great deal one way or the other in terms of the support for or the potential opposition to this plan right here. But, I mean, it's a place to look, and I imagine back in the minutes of some of the hearings when that vessel-based statute was originally passed and when there was the first fight about the sunset date when it did get extended, there might be some interesting things out there in basis in the minutes that would bear looking at as debate on this proposal goes forward.
Yeah, and I was just looking for, Madam Chair, I was seeing if there was a nexus between that and what's trying to happen here, if we haven't sort of already set a precedent for doing this, and if it's this is unconstitutional, why wasn't that? So I'm kind of trying to get my hands around the similarities and the differences in those two fisheries, and quite frankly, I don't see a lot.
Madam Chairman, I think Representative Johnson's correct. There isn't a great deal. But, I mean, I certainly if this were going to go forward, I would probably want to go back and spend some time looking through the what was said in basis at that time to see if there are any arguments that were advanced one way or the other that might inform this debate. But at first glance, I think you're probably right, Representative Johnson, Madam Chairman.
And Madam Chair, I just encourage the representative from Sitka to look into that because that was a fairly contentious couple of sessions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Herron.
In the backup for that the sponsors provided, there is a letter from the United
Representative Herron.
There is a letter from the United Southeast Alaska Gillnetters, and you're addressing very technical and legal terms. This letter is a lot about. Of other things. Have you had a chance to read it?
Madam Chairman, Representative Herron, no, I have not actually seen the letter from the...
Okay.
So I'm happy to look at that, though.
Yeah, I'd like to, if you could provide, Madam Chair, the sort of your take on this, because it's very, to say the least, it's very strident and violently opposed to the bill, but I think I guess I'd... You don't have to do it now, of course, but if you could... provide the committee through the chair sort of your perspective. I guess I kind of want to understand where they're coming from.
Madam Chairman, Representative Herron, I'll be happy to review the letter from the United Southeast Alaska Gillnetters. It is 2.5 pages long, and so I probably would be better off reviewing it and not trying to answer on the fly.
Great. Thank you. Are there any other questions? Oh, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ben, thank you for being here today. Appreciate that. And because you are, you know, the chairman of the CFEC, you might be able to elaborate a little bit more as to what, if House Bill 366 were to pass forward, I understand that there's some concerns about how that might impact the value of current permits being held, but I don't understand how it would potentially impact the value of permits being held, current permits being held by owners. Can you elaborate as to maybe what some of those, what the basis of some of those fears would be?
Madam Chairman, Representative Ortiz, first of all, I'm not the chairman of the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, just for the record. I am one of the commissioners. Bruce Twomley is the chairman. And if he were here, I'm sure he would probably have a better answer than I'm about to provide. But to respond to your question, Representative Ortiz, Madam Chairman, is... permits are a market. You know, they're market forces, free market forces that drive how we set the fees based on their values. And this would be a change. I guess I've said this before, but the invisible hand that currently creates what a permit is worth on the market, which is part of the problem because it's driving values up to where they're not affordable by young fishermen, might become visible, and we don't really know what the effect would be. It would really depend on the level of activity. The more robust the response to this legislation was, you know, if all 16 regions established a permit bank, and if all of those permit banks purchased the maximum number of permits allowed, and there are some questions that I didn't raise about what that maximum is because some of the exceptions to 10 weren't clear to me, and it's in the analysis in our fiscal note. I've written most of this out, Chairman Twomley and I have. So I think we just know that there's a potential for there to be some effect on permits that are held not by regional permit banks because that's what happens when markets get distorted, but we don't know what that effect would be. It might make the permits more valuable to other people because the leased ones would be taking that stock out of the fishery. It might have a different effect just depending on how active people were participating. I think it would really depend on And this is what Representative Chris Thompson said generally. It would depend on what the permit banks did. If you got a bunch of really interested, energized board members in those permit banks, and they went out of their way to really aggressively do everything possible under this new statute, then it would be likely there would be a greater economic effect on the other permits remaining in the fishery. You'll see in the fiscal note analysis that we provided that our research section was cognizant of probably a need to do some specific research on permit bank permits and how they were fished and what kind of earnings they returned and what the we would need to look and see what those lease terms were and what was being paid for the lease. And there might be some ancillary effect on the vessels that were being also leased by the same fishermen who were the lessees of these permits. So I don't really have a good question other than that we would certainly want to make sure our research staff did a thorough job monitoring the effects economically on the fishery, just like we do with fisheries right now in the current system.
Follow up, Representative Ortiz?
Yes, and I'm probably having to explain Economics 101 to me, but your answer included the how active the different communities might become in pursuing this opportunity. That activity, to me, in my limited understanding, means that they would become more competitive in the process of getting access to these permits. So would that necessarily cause a downward value on the permits themselves?
Madam Chairman, Representative Ortiz, I would think that would be a less likely outcome. I think, you know, just at you know, conjecturing at this point, the goal would be to get more people fishing the permits, and so you would think that would probably make the other ones more valuable. Where it might become kind of an interesting question is if there was a fleet reduction measure in a fishery where one of these permit banks had started buying up some of the permits, and if that would lead to a potential situation of excessive exclusivity. But probably, I mean, the goal here is to get more permits out, get them fished more, have more fish landed, and have more economic beneficial returns to Alaskans. So if all of those laudable goals go forward, then the remaining permits would probably maintain their value or increase in value. And then, of course, the downside of that would be if you were not fortunate enough to be able to be a lessee of one of these permits from a permit bank and you had to acquire one the traditional way, that bar would have been raised higher for others who weren't able to benefit. And then, again, there's some escape mechanisms to the 10-permit maximum in the bill as drafted. How vigorous these boards of directors would be in petitioning the Commissioner of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development to grant waivers, and I guess the real question I don't know the answer to is what acquisition that makes a fishery, a permit bank's portfolio a better representation, I don't know what that necessarily means. So the answer to that question would probably directly help answer the question of how active one of these permit banks could be.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Chris Tompkins.
I might be able to offer some perspective also to that question. And, you know, in conversations I've had, there's been, you know, questions both whether this would drive up permit prices or drive down permit prices. I've heard it both ways. I would agree with Ben's basic analysis. I mean, this is a free market. You've got a certain number of actors in that market. The legislation is tailored and intended to be a very, very small, I mean, de minimis fraction of that market. So there's a 4% cap on total ownership. I think it's probably unlikely that gets realized in many regions. Maybe the wisdom of the legislature lowers that cap. The idea is that you just have a very small number of permits that are available to be accessed by new and young fishermen to use for a short period of time before buying outright. So the idea is that you have such a small number that it doesn't distort the free markets as is. And that percentage of permits is relatively insignificant to the number of latent permits in many fisheries, actually. So I could see theoretically how there could be an economic effect. Maybe this is committee work down the road, but you have such a small number that would actually be held by a permit bank that it shouldn't have a substantial or significant effect on markets. So just some context in terms of supply and demand.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Herron.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ben, and this could be for the sponsor as well, is this model used anywhere else?
Madam Chairman, Representative Herron, I'm not aware that it is used anywhere else.
Thank you. Representative Johnson?
Madam Chair, I might have an answer to that question.
Okay.
Also, if you'd like.
Okay, go forward.
I think Ben's right. Although there's a very analogous system, which are community quota entities, CQEs, which exist around the Gulf of Alaska, they haven't really taken off because basically the economics of halibut quota are so awful right now for anyone trying to get in. But it's a similar idea in that you've got an entity that can hold quota and lease it out to new entrants to that fishery. So different system, federal management, and you have a quota-based system instead of a permit-based system, but that was actually one of the models we really closely looked at.
Thank you. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I guess the policy call for me is not whether or not is the goal to maintain the value of the permits or put people on the water fishing. And so, to me, that's the policy call. And if we want to maintain the value of the permits, then we probably don't want to do this. Or stay status quo. If we want to put people fishing, then it seems to be a way to do that. So I think the policy call here is, are we wanting to harvest the resource, or are we wanting to maintain the value of the permits? And I think that's something that we need to look at. And I know there's probably some commercial fishermen here and say we want to do both, and that's the perfect world. But I think that's the policy we need to be looking at, is where do we want, are we after the resource, or are we after protecting the value of the permits? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes. Are there any other questions for the commissioner? Okay. Seeing none. Thank you, Commissioner. Appreciate that. And seeing, having no further business to come before this committee, we will adjourn at 11:26.